Hi, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the last day of public events at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, and what a lovely day it's been. My name is Susan Mansfield, I'm a journalist and writer, and it's my pleasure and privilege to be here today with Danny Dorley. Can I just ask, in the first instance, that you make sure that your phones are turned off or on silent? The last event I chaired had several phones ringing, and we know who you are, or we will find out. Danny Dorley, I think we're in for a treat this afternoon. Danny Dorley is the Holford MacKinder Professor of Human Geography at Oxford. He's the author of books, including All That Is Solid, about housing injustice, why social inequality still exists, and a better politics. And we're going to be talking today mostly about this book, People and Places, a 21st Century Atlas of the UK, co-authored with Beth and Thomas. And this is really a book of the analysis of the results of the 2011 census, and comparing it with the previous census 10 years before, and a translation of that into really rather beautiful, we'll see some of them, maps and cartographs and diagrams. And if that is all sounding a bit abstract, what you need to know is that this is really the stuff of life. This is housing and families and immigration and whether people are wealthy or poor and what opportunities we all have, how we live and how that changes, and how decisions are then made by politicians which affect those things, sometimes quite dramatically. And we'll hear some of that. Owen Jones said of this book, it's a must if you want to understand modern Britain. So without further ado, please welcome Danny Dorley.
Thanks so much for that. We have a little trick when lecturing students. If a mobile phone goes off, they have to pass it forward before they answer it. And then you answer it at the front and just take a message to the student. I promise not to do that. Okay, we will do it here. You can pretend it's a kind of demographic survey. It's a bit biased. You ask, what were you doing last night? And who were you with? People and Places, 21st Century Atlas. I've been involved with Beth and Thomas, my co-author, with doing these kind of things for 30 years. I started at the 71 census, which was the first computerised, the 81, 91, 2000, 2011. I really don't want to be doing this again in 10 years' time. But quantitative human geography, looking at numbers, has kind of died a death in Britain, and it needs to revive very quickly, because I'm getting too old, as you'll see with this. But there are exciting things. I'll show you some in a minute. There are exciting claims you can make about how the UK is changing. And we'll probably end by talking about change in the last year and the last 6 months. But you've got to remember, when you get obsessed by very, very recent changes, that underlie all of this, there are longer term shifts. And the recent changes aren't the longer term shifts, but they're also a product of the longer term changes. Now, you might think 2011 is quite a long time ago. We won't get the next census for 2021, if we get it at all. The incoming coalition government in 2010, or I should say the Conservative part of that government, tried to cut the 2011 census and found out that the contracts that had already been signed with the American firms who were going to take the census had a penalty clause which was so large, luckily, it would have cost more to cut it. The reason they wanted to cut it was, if you can remember back to 2010, there's a star chamber process, and whichever minister could cut the most was going to be allowed in this special group of super ministers. One of them, I think, tried to get rid of trees or something. Anyway, we got the census, but what the Atlas also does is take the most recent data, which is often just national, sometimes regional, and just shows how things are coming on moving since 2011 to 2014, sometimes 2015. This is just showing average age of mothers continuing to go up. This has to stop at some point, obviously. There are lots, this is very banal and simple social science, but some of the most interesting things in social science are trends that can't possibly carry on. That way you know you're living in really interesting times. I'll just tell you one global statistic that makes me very, very happy. About 5-6 years ago, infant mortality in the world fell from 42 babies in every 1,000 dying to 40. About 5% drop in just 1 year. The best ever news story in the world. After then, I just checked last week, years after then, it fell even faster every single year. If infant mortality carries on falling in the world at the rate it is, not a single baby will die in the year 2030. Now that's not going to happen, sadly. But what that should tell you is two things. One is that we are living in absolutely remarkable times globally. And secondly, our media are completely incapable of reporting good news. Just a couple more of these. Reasons you need to worry about these simple figures. This is obviously babies and then toddlers. And you can see changes. That's a percentage of the population in Britain who are of these ages. And you can see we're not going to need so many primary schools fairly soon. Which means anybody who's setting up a free school, a primary free school, really ought to know about these kind of numbers. The reason we have censuses and accountings is to plan for changes that are predictable as long as you plan for them. And this one affects me, 3 to 17 year olds. You can see a big drop 2011 to 2012. A couple of years through that begins to click in. You might have noticed when the figures came out a few weeks ago about the biggest increase in students going to university ever. Partly because there isn't anything else to do at age 18, but partly because universities can take more because the size of the cohort is beginning to shrink. Let alone when you start to worry about what the students will get from mainland Europe or carry on coming. And now a much more complicated graph. This graph took Bethan weeks and weeks to make. It starts in 1841, goes all the way through to 2011, and all these colours, I know you can't see these names, but these are countries. And it's a graph of who was living in Britain at each of these census dates who was born in another country. If we were in the United States of America, you would be very familiar with this graph. Because this graph is a kind of graph which is celebrated in the USA. It's a melting pot graph. It's a graph to show where everybody came from and how they all mix together. I haven't heard anybody clapping this graph yet. I'm not saying you're particularly worried about it, but it has different implications in Britain because of the way we see immigration. From Ireland, first of all, now very low, a whole plethora of countries. And one reason why I say more's happened in the last 15 years than the last 50 is that rise. So it looks like a huge rise, but these are absolute numbers. That's 8 million people. At the same time, and it's harder to count, we've had a large number of people leave. After the 71 recession, the 81 recession, and the 91 recession, more people actually left than came in. The 2008 global crash was different. What's a huge number of people? A few hundred thousands, one way or another, every year, isn't actually huge. That's why Swindon is always used as the example. And we can talk more about it. I'm going to show you quite a few pictures of where people have actually come to. There's the cover. The cover of the book is a bit disingenuous because it's the only map which looks like a map. The rest of the book, the map looks like this. Here's Scotland. We are here. I'm going to be talking, I'm afraid, a lot about London and the South East. Partly because I don't know enough about Scotland. I'm more likely to embarrass myself, partly because so much change has happened there. Well, this map is stretched so that everybody gets the same amount of space, so you can see where people actually are. 10 years ago, Bethan and I divided the UK into two halves along this line, based on census data up to 2001. And we said the country had become a core. This was the very centre of London. This was core London. This was inner London. This was London suburbs, going all the way out to Oxford and Cambridge. And outer London went down to Cornwall, and right up to the Suffolk coast. Because if you're looking at economic performance of cities or numerous trends, the main determinant was how long does it take a train at 9 o'clock in the morning to get to London. That predicted whether Bristol did well, or Hastings did well, or Liverpool did well. And then north of this line, the UK is divided into a series of cities, a bit like islands, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Leeds, Bradford, Sheffield, Birmingham, Liverpool, Manchester. A set of islands of medium prosperity, often surrounded by areas that got poorer and poorer. Quite different from the south, where you have islands of affluence around the Cotswolds, where they become of this. He hasn't always moved, doesn't he? He's going to give up there, and now he's gone to a £70 million house somewhere here. Many things get better, and we adapt to it getting better and think of it perfectly normally. In 2011, we had civil partnerships mapped for the first time. And they're highest in London and Brighton, as you might expect, and Manchester. But also, oddly up here, Blackpool, which you might not have thought as a place. Maybe more interesting, this red area here is marriages in general, all marriages, it's going down. So it's going up. So it's right, we shouldn't have called it red, because it goes red, it's going down. In 1991, London became the first town, city or village in the UK to have the majority of people of working age not being married. And then not marrying became more and more normal. London now has the first increase in marriage. And it's interesting to think why that might be. I suspect immigration rules have had an effect. But if you don't earn 18,000, you can still be deported. But you have to guess these things, you can't tell the census. I need to speed on so you get enough time to chat. Lots of graphs like this show you how many people have arrived from Lithuania, Latvia, Hungary, Romania, Italy. And maps like this, this is about Ireland, it's all blue, because the Irish are dying. We have wave after wave after wave of groups of immigrants. All are despised and hated when they arrive. Within 20 years they're accepted as part of us, and then within over 50 years we start to lament the fact that they've begun to disappear. Italians dropping in areas like Bedford, which is partly why we don't have enough bricks to build houses. Coming in, Romanians still rising in London. These are all the countries, the main countries in Asia, which are not India and China. Ridiculous amount of detail. I tried to cut down on the amount of detail, but you really just have to show the numbers to give an idea. It's not an out of control increase. Many of the groups are actually going down as well as up. But overall, we're getting a rise. And the main reason we're getting a rise is that people are moving further. The biggest rise in 2011 in people born in one country living in another in the UK, the biggest in the good group, were English-born people who'd moved to Wales and Scotland. Often elderly English-born people, because it becomes normal to be a bit braver in your retirement. Right? And we don't think of the English-born as immigrants in the UK, but those are the largest groups. But we also have huge numbers, millions, of elderly middle-class people who've retired to mainland Europe, where they get free healthcare. This map is the change where these people came to between 2001 and 2009 census. And again, it's so much a story of London and particular parts of London, but also cities with universities. These areas, which are all light, had either no change or a change of below 0.4%. And just the stereotype, the strongest correlation outside of Scotland with the vote to leave was the areas in which nobody had come. That is a remarkably strong correlation. There were a few exceptions like Great Yarmouth and Peterborough, but apart from those few exceptions, The fewer people who divide from the rest of Europe or anywhere else in your area, the more likely you were to feel that you needed more sovereignty. The more people who divide, as in London, the more likely you being somebody allowed to vote, which means you have to be an Irish or UK or Commonwealth citizen, the more likely were you to not think you needed a change in sovereignty. Here's African countries, and look, almost stable, it's not going down slightly. The green are people born in a country in Africa moving out because other groups are moving in, just as the Irish were pushed out beforehand. This is mixed ethnicity. One of the joys of watching the census since 1991 has been watching how many couples are mixing, how many babies have been produced, but also how careful Democrats were not to talk about it in 91, because of racism was so much worse in 91. There's a taboo against mixed couples. 2012, 13, 14, got up to 0.95%. We're almost at 1% of our population being of mixed ethnicity. Not quite. And the areas of the biggest increase, no longer just London, but parts of Birmingham, parts of Leicester, parts of the South Coast, parts of Bristol. White working class. Graph gets produced 2 years ago. Theresa May produces it in a press release over the bank holiday weekend. There's going to be a government audit of injustice and inequality, including worrying about education for the white working class and why the white working class, white, English, Scottish, North, Irish, British, are at the bottom of this table, with just mixed Asian, Asian, British, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, white Irish, and Gypsy and travellers doing worse. All that data comes from the census. Only the census is detailed enough and asks enough people, in effect everybody, questions to allow you to look at small groups of the population and then compare them. I'm going to zoom in on London and South East, and I'm going to go through really, really quickly. You've got to memorise that math, I'm afraid. The census data help you. If you happen to come from any of these areas, that's Oxford, that's Cambridge, that's Brighton. Memorise your strange block, and then you can see what happens to it. I've moved up, that's university students. The only thing that was still going high in the north, look at the number of students still going up to 2014. This is people working over 48 hours a week. All the purples are decreases, apart from there. And what happened after the banking crash is that, to put it crudely, lots of bankers were sacked who lived around here, and junior bankers, and the bankers in the middle have to work longer hours. I'm afraid there's an awful amount of stereotyping that happens when you do this, but at least you're looking at the numbers. People with degrees are increasing, carries on increasing, it's now 35% of the population, 16 to, actually say, 59 to 64, up to 2014. But no increase here. This part of London's reached saturation level. There's no more space for anybody else with a degree there, because so many people have come in with degrees. This is people with no qualifications. Look, increasing people with no qualifications. Now, a little bit of it is people with qualifications from overseas that they can't work out what on earth they are. But some of it is completely unskilled labour now being demanded in that part of London. Because there are increasing numbers of servants. The servants may not be living in the houses, they may be living in effect dormitory accommodation. But if you want to get London clubs cleaned and you want them sat overnight, somebody has to be there. And so people have actually zoomed in on the Pall Mall area of London and found parts of that where there are little enclaves of people with no qualifications. Sometimes we go out of debt, forget the map, or it's changing education, that's Oxford, that's Cambridge, that's Brighton. Since the 2011 census, this is a drop in jobs in education and similar public services. So you can begin to count cuts. Banking and finance and insurance, all these purple and red areas are where people were sacked, so we get less. With the crash, and that's an increase. So there's a geography of winners and losers from 2008, 9, and 10. And then since 2011, it's back up again. But a little bit of that will be associations. And they're having a really, really bad time right now. Not here, not in Scotland, but in England. Other household types. This is where you share with another family or some other kind of unusual arrangement. And just look at the increase in out of London and other household types. This is people not being able to often get the housing they want. So you're living in a house with your two children who've grown up, one of your child has a child, and they stay in a house and become a third generation household, and you're really, really crowded. That kind of thing is increasing around out of London. Rooms per person has gone up in most of the country. We have enough housing, not necessarily in the right place, but it's gone down in London, particularly East London. Health. This is dramatic, I think. 2009-10, 2011-12-13, proportion of the population who said that their health was okay. Massive drop in this. This was part of David Cameron's Happiness Index. It was announced in 2010, in November, that we're going to measure happiness. And they're going to use a basket of 31 measures of happiness. To my mind, the most and well-being. The most important measure was the health measure. The most important thing to you is your health. It's easy when you get old to realise this. But it really is. The population of the UK has been telling the people who collect the happiness index data every year their health has been getting worse. And then in 2012, we had a decrease in life expectancy for elderly women. 2013, it got worse. 2014 wasn't a good year. 2015, we got 50,000 more deaths than the year before, and life expectancy beginning to fall for the elderly in Britain. And the biggest rise in deaths was in Scotland. Still hasn't been fully reported. But you need a census to know this is happening, because the census tells you how many people are there, so you can work out if the rate is getting worse. And also surveys that actually ask people about their health. And this coincides with austerity. It may be a magical new illness that nobody understands, but there have been investigations to try to see if it is a magical new illness, and they can't find one. The most dramatic change between the last few censuses is a doubling in the number of people private renting between 2001 and 2015. Up to 10 million private renters now. That's a national doubling, even faster in London, and since 2010 it's just shooting up. We're trying to go back to the 1930s as fast as we can at the moment. It's a very crude way of saying what's going on right now. Almost at the end, I talked about this little map at the start. The reason for showing that map is we defined that map in 2001. What we've done in this atlas is then use that map where we haven't fixed the areas. We haven't fixed them after the new data. Not that we'd be tempted to, you never know, you want to produce a nice story. We use the areas that were defined 10 years ago, and then we've looked at change to 2011. And it's incredibly closely related. Population has gone up most in the centre of London, then the core, then what we call in London, then the out. The archipelago centres has gone up because that's where the universities are in the north of Scotland and Wales. The only exception is this edge, which you can hardly see here, but Orkney, Shetland, Western Isles. Increasing numbers of people, relatively high, absolutely low, are trying to get away from it all and going off to the edge. I'm very happy, as you can tell, to talk about political things. The census only exists because the government failed to cut it. The census could easily be cut before 2021. The census began in 1801 because of political fears about population. The census is a very political thing. The key date is 2019, when the Census Act has to be passed. It is, if not passed in Parliament, we do not get a census in 2021. And lastly, just to show we can go up to date, here's a strange map of England, and it's England shaped by the loss in equity in house prices from around a month before the Brexit vote to 2 months after the vote to leave. So far, only £4 billion has been lost. In London, the drop in value of houses of people who bought in the 9 months before Brexit is £1 billion. £1 billion is tiny because a street of houses in a very posh part of Chelsea can cost £1 billion. But what's really interesting is this colouring. Now, the simpler data won't include all recent transactions, but the transactions in the market have dropped by 70% in London, Berkshire and Oxfordshire, by 65% to 70% elsewhere, but less than 65% still dropping in those areas. It's looking like the beginnings of a fall in house prices starting from London and rippling out. This we will know in about 6 weeks' time. So in one part of the country where there hasn't been falls, just one, out of all London boroughs, all counties of England, and that's where, that's Scotland. It's Scotland. Scotland's had a 1% rise. Scotland is going in a different direction in many, many ways. But Scotland wouldn't be unaffected if this thing does crash, because London currently has the biggest housing bubble in world history. Thank you very much.
Danny, and it should let you get your breath back for a minute after all that. There's so many things that I'd like to come back on, and I think one of the really interesting things about what's in this book is the way that it overturns some of the things that we sort of take for granted because we've vaguely heard about them somewhere. What you said about immigration, that this huge political football that we saw being kind of kicked around before the Brexit vote, the figures seem to suggest that we have as many people emigrating from Britain as we have coming in. And therefore, what's the problem? Is that?
Depends how you look at it. We've been counting this kind of thing since 1801. Before 1801, we couldn't count this because we didn't know how many people were here. We became very interested in immigration in 1851 because of a famine in Ireland. Over the period since 1841 to now, in most years we've had more emigration than immigration, and in aggregate we've had a huge amount of emigration because we are the immigrants of the world. We were forced out of the UK and we filled up other people's countries. And as I said, even after the 71, 81, 91 recessions, more people left. Do you remember how Alfie's the same pet? That kind of thing, cheap labour going to the mainland. The years of immigration, it's only been relatively recently that we've had net immigration of up to 300,000. There's an incredibly strong correlation between immigration and births 30 years earlier. In the 1920s and 30s, we had very low birth rates, so low the government worried that the population was actually going to be decimated by the end of the century. How did we solve the fact we didn't have babies in the 20s and 30s? We brought people in the 1950s, particularly the 60s, from the Caribbean and the subcontinent to replace the people who were never born. We've done the same recently. We had very, very low birth rates in the 1970s. And since, the last time we were 2 children per couple, I think it was 1965, 66, we don't produce enough children to replace ourselves. This is no great problem. The world produces enough children at the moment. But essentially, these things balance out. We are an ageing population still. We're a population who cannot staff our health services and our care homes, and we do it by immigration. And that's why we've had that. The other thing well worth saying is that a lot of the emigration we've had recently has been economically very valuable emigration. It's emigration of people post-retirement who've gone to live somewhere sunny and no longer use our health service. So currently, emigration, we take in young, fit people who haven't paid for their education, and we lose David Cameron's father, Nick Clegg's father. They're the people who, and many others not quite as wealthy, who go and spend their final days somewhere else.
So it sounds like we're doing badly on that one. But you mentioned there about an ageing population, and I think this is another thing that a lot of us think, that people are getting older, living longer, that there are more and more people in the oldest demographics. Actually, looking at this book, that the oldest age brackets seem to be falling a bit.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how that.
Yeah, they're going around. A lot of the staff of the book have to explain about age cohorts, because ageing hasn't yet happened. It is going to happen, and academics tend to want to look for the next thing, so they talk a lot about ageing. But like I said, we had very few births in the 1920s and 1930s. Then there were remarkably few births during the war. Well, not remarkably, it's fairly obvious why there weren't many births in the war. Some of them were American. Then, in fact, the only year in which more men instigated divorce than women was 1945. Because of what went on. Women always, in the majority, say when it's time to give up a relationship. There's more fun in these statistics. 1946, 9 months after troops came home, we got a baby boom. High in 1947, 1948, then slowed down. Born in 1946 makes you now, who can do the maths? 70. Yeah. So we have remarkably few numbers right now. 71-year-olds, 72, 73. Very few of them, because they weren't born. We've got a lot of 70-year-olds. Our 70-year-olds are pretty fit. I mean, there's been a remarkable change in health. And a lot of 69 and 68-year-olds. But that's now, not in 2011 when we did the census. So we're about to get ageing. We're about to get a population who, in about 10 or 15 years' time, will be much more needy, will require care homes and health services, much more than we currently do. But at the moment, we've had a kind of boom, of being able to prepare a wonderful social care and health system ready for our old age. I mean, the thing that gets me most about immigration, like I say, we've had rising death rates in the elderly, this is particularly 85-year-olds and 90-year-olds. And the problem is people don't worry about death rates rising in 85 and 90. It's like, they're going to die anyway. But people are dying 3 years, 5 years before they were a few years ago, which means that things are worse than they were. And if you look forward, I'm 48. If I look 30, which I can just, I don't think I'll be around 40 years' time. Who's going to care for me? Who's going to put the catheter in my body? Who are we going to let in to do that? Or are we going to change our society to one in which, if I can't pay somebody to do it, then I don't really deserve to have that kind of care? And one reason I do these things and look at census is to try to get people to think forward to their own old age. Because some of the people who are worst affected at the moment by what's happened in the country are elderly, very elderly, and particularly frail elderly. And that's not a very powerful political group.
It'd be good to just maybe tease that out slightly more, because we were talking about this in the green room, and what you're actually talking about is a really significant increase in the number of deaths in the older age groups in the last two or three years. Really, it's pretty recent, isn't it?
Yeah.
And is this, we're seeing the effects of austerity, is that what this is about?
I've looked and looked and looked, and other people have looked. The original government line was flu. The evidence for flu, this is 2012, 2013 and 2015. If it is flu, it's the most remarkable new strain of flu that we haven't seen. Flu epidemics peak in about 5 weeks. They're very obvious. You get lab reports, you know it's flu. And people write down flu on death certificates more than they have done. They don't say people have been dying of dementia and Alzheimer's, which is actually what the cause of death has been. So we know it's been poor care for those people. And the correlation of austerity is just too tight. The form of flu that we had, which was very, very minor in 2015, is the Hong Kong flu, which affected mainly young people. I think one of the most worrying things I've seen the statements on this by Public Health England was when it first happened, they said this is mainly affecting elderly people, and then they said this kind of flu affects, just a change in wording, There's no evidence that this kind of flu affects. So it's cut. In the atlas, we have the graph showing people reporting these rising levels of saying that they were unhappy with their health year after year after year. So the population was saying, before the deaths occurred, that they were feeling worse. The geography of the deaths is really interesting. Although it is a bit higher in Scotland, in England and Wales, it's spread right across the country. It's not poor areas. So it includes leafy home counties. And I think what is happening, say somewhere like South Oxfordshire where the deaths have gone up, is that an 85-year-old who suddenly finds that things go wrong, they break their hip, they can no longer drive, there isn't a bus service, there isn't Meals on Wheels, there isn't a strong community in those kind of places. You're not living in terraced houses. You're living in a little detached cottage with a garden around it. You don't want to be living in a little detached cottage with a garden around it when you can't drive and nobody's coming to knock on the door because of the cuts. And I think it's a very sad increase in deaths that's occurred. And it's the saddest thing is the way it has not gone noticed. If you take mid-year to mid-year, the way the government do it, the rise in deaths is 52,000. The last time we had a rise in deaths of 52,000 in 1 year was 1940. That's people coming back injured from Dunkirk, and it's the bombing. David Cameron will be the first post-war Prime Minister to leave office with life expectancy falling. Before 1940, it's the very cold winter of 1929, it's the flu epidemic of 1918, it's the cold winter of 1895, it's the cholera outbreak of 1846. It's in the top 12 biggest events of the last 140 years. But all those other events killed young people. The problem with what happened in 2015 and 12 and 13 is it's rising deaths, first of all of elderly women, and then of elderly people in general. And I can't help thinking that somewhere in the British elite, somebody was thinking, well, this saves us some money. Otherwise, why hasn't anybody shouted?
That's astonishing and really, really chilling. I'm glad that you're here to tell us, because otherwise we just wouldn't know, I think. Yeah. It's not widely reported at all. I'd like to open up to questions in a couple of minutes. I just wanted to ask you, before I do that, to comment a little bit on inequality and we hear about the widening gap between rich and poor, and the falling off of social mobility between those groups. Is that still going on? Is that something that's
concerning? Is it still happening? Oh, you can see it in the census and the effects. So the census counts, it's the only way we know how many rooms there are in our houses. We used to count toilets, all kinds of things. We used to count whether you had hot water in 71. The census shows that by 2011, we had allocated our rooms, if you liked, mainly for the market system, but also through social housing, more unequally than we had at any time since 1921. So inequality in housing carries on rising. More people own two houses, three houses, or have a very large house and there's one of them. At the other end of the scale, more people are being crowded into housing and rates of overcrowding are increasing. Half of it is economic inequality. The other half is the beginning of ageing, but it's only just started. So that's people living to 80 or 90 in a family house. Our housing system is designed for when we die at 75. And we haven't got a way of moving out of family houses into somewhere smaller. That's a problem. But you see inequality in all the maps rising. The gaps between areas become sharper and more distinct. It becomes much more important to worry about where you live. If you've got a choice, which a declining number of people have, but if you've got a choice, you suddenly find that in town after town after town, one little quarter is filling up with the middle class and the professionals, and they're shunning the rest of the town in a way they didn't do 20 or 30 or 40 years earlier. And they're crowding round the posh comprehensive. That's essentially what's happening.
That's really interesting. I'd like to have some questions now. I'm sure there are things you want to ask Danny. There's been so much in that. We've got a mic, yeah. Do you want to come over to the gentleman here, and then there's a lady over the other side. Do you want to come over this way and then over that way?
I'm a little bit concerned about the way that some of your data is presented. It seems to me that in many cases you presented us with bar graphs with the zero suppressed, so that in fact what is actually a very small change year on year appears as a very large change. And I wonder whether it's fair to draw inferences from what are actually quite small changes in magnitude. How can you show that these have huge causal effects which you tend to be attributing to them?
You can't show that anything has a causal effect just by showing relationships. We can't put the zeros on the graphs, otherwise all the graphs would just look like that. Very often, zero doesn't mean anything. In that, you know, if you're going to do percent of people who are male, it would be a bit silly to start off with zero, because a population, we've never had a population of the world which is, or anywhere in it, which is entirely female. When a change is meaningful is when it's repeated, if it carries on many times. And the simplest maths you can do of that is just binomial tossing of a coin. If something is random, it can go either way. If it goes down and down and down and down again, you've got to toss a coin four times to get that by chance. So the way, what I use to say something is significant, is if it happens repeatedly, it really does look like it's going down. And when it's really interesting is if it's been going one way for 30 years and then begins to go the other way and does it repeatedly. So that's the way of knowing whether you've got something interesting occurring or whether it's more likely to be chance.
Thank you. This question is in no way meant to take away from the work that you have done, but I was interested in what your thoughts were on the limitations of census data, either the questions they ask or the people they manage to capture, and what, if anything, you do to improve census data.
Okay, that's a great question. So census is a very, very simple thing. You know, it's between 20 and 40 questions, only asked every 10 years. The most interesting question on census is relationships within households. Who is living with you and what's your relationship with them? In America, they ask people's income on the census. You know, we decided that was too embarrassing to do and don't do it. I would like to ask income. I'd like to ask wealth. We could link in the revenue data and DWP data centres, not actually ask people, just actually get it right. Because people aren't that good at actually knowing what their income is. It sounds strange, but they get it wrong. At the moment, I'm just worried about keeping this Victorian thing going. The minister who wanted to cut it didn't realise that it's actually a Victorian tradition. It's not particularly radical. There are many ways of studying people which don't involve numbers, and they can tell you an awful lot. In a kind of brave new world with numbers, we've moved towards a Scandinavian system where you routinely collect data about a population and you publish it and you allow people to analyse it, including publishing everybody's tax record. So you can see how much your next door neighbour's paid in tax. And then if they've got a very big car outside their house, you can phone up the tax authorities and say you think they might be needing to pay a bit more tax. Now this sounds very strange to us, but if you really want to get rid of a bit of tax evasion in this country, the way that would get rid of it would actually be having a Swedish system of saying how much tax. And people should be proud of paying tax. You know, how do you think you get hospitals and schools?
I've got a gentleman in the second room, quite shut, and then there's a lady at the end of the locker room there. Thank you, Dan. That was brilliant. But just one question that occurs to me is, we're now living in a world where corporations and government know so much about every detail of our life, where we shop, what we buy, what we're even watching on the internet, etc. So I'm wondering how that correlates with the importance of having the census. And is the census, the very fact that they don't want to do the next one, is that about hiding something, or is it because it's no longer necessary given the changes that have been in place?
That's a great question. There's a book coming out called Weapons of Mathematics, Destruction, which should be published very soon, about all the data held by corporations. My main thought about this is that corporations want you to think, and their customers, and that's not you, that's people who buy their services from them, to think that their data is brilliant, that they can actually match up your internet browsing record with your Tesco Club card with something else. It's in their vested interests that you think that Big Brother is out there because they want to sell this information to advertisers. Whenever I've seen this data, the quality has been absolutely appalling, because the reality is 24 young people in an office somewhere near Woking constantly leaving their jobs because it's too boring and having to hire somebody else, and somebody saying, oh yeah, the central file's on that disk. The quality control in the private sector is absolutely abysmal, because it's really, really hard and boring to do. What the census does is gives us the best quality data on very simple things. The key thing you may not know about the census is there isn't just a census. About 3 weeks after the census, there's a 600,000 person follow-up survey. It's called Capture Recapture, to try to work out how many of you tried not to fill it in, and how many of you lied or just got it wrong on what you filled in. And the two are compared, and then the census is corrected before it gets out. Now you may think, what happens about all the people who managed to avoid both the census and the 600,000 survey? We can actually work out how many of you there are. And the way it's done is called Capture Recapture. It comes from how they try to work out how many whales there are in the ocean. It's very hard to count whales because they're underwater. So how do you count them? You harpoon them, you pull them out, don't kill them, leave a marker in them, let them go. You harpoon again, pull them out, check to see if there's a marker. And that information can help you work out how many whales there are that you didn't capture either time. And the census does clever things like that. So it includes a count of people who are trying to avoid counting. But we even go to the level of measuring the amount of sewage that areas produce to try to work out how many people are around illegally. There are various things. Yeah? Yeah, because you're only going to produce a certain amount as a human being. We think the number of people who've managed to be in the country and are not documented is around about 500,000. There are other ways as well of doing this. It's a bit obsessive, but there's a huge interest in, you know, who are living in beds and sheds, who are squeezed into various housing. And there's lots of scare stories about millions and millions of people. It turns out at any one time there's about 500,000 people who haven't got entirely legal papers. But often they're just somebody, middle class, maybe from America, who's on a tourist visa, actually, you know, they're included in the undocumented.
Yes.
Since 2000, we're told over 3 million additional people are in Britain. And I wondered if you ever compare your census with the Treasury Red Book figures, because it does seem to me that we've allowed all these additional people in, and we've provided absolutely zero in terms of infrastructure or other normal support that one would require for such a number.
Well, the biggest reason has been a rise in population. We've now got a population of around 63, 64 million people. About 3 million of those are these magical net immigrants, net immigrants don't actually exist. They're immigrants minus emigrants, but about 3 million of them are net immigrants since that period. A bigger part of the reason why we got 63 million is, until recently, improved life expectancy. Until 2011, 2012, life expectancy was going up by about a third of a year. So we've got it, you know, a bigger increase there. And the other reason is births, which, although they're low, are still enough to increase our population. We have planned very badly for all these things. We've planned very badly for births. So now, if you're in a county where all the schools are academies, who decides when you get a new secondary school? I live in a county like this. It's called Oxfordshire. The local education authority no longer feels it has a responsibility to work out where the new secondary school is going to go. Toby Young tried to start one. Luckily, we managed to stop Toby Young. But the new secondary school still has to be a free school. It's not organised by government. A group of parents and a couple of teachers and a headmaster. And it's supposed to open in exactly 12 months by now, when the children will be 11. They failed to find anywhere to even start building it. That's bad planning. We planned really badly for increases in life expectancy. Where we haven't planned badly is the immigration of 3 million people. Because disproportionate numbers of these 3 million are care home workers, our doctors, our nurses, our teachers who are teaching in our schools for the children. Now, it's a market system. It isn't that we went out and said, let's get the kind of people we need. But what we got was the kind of people we need. Because the way immigration works is you move somewhere, and if there isn't something for you to do, you go again. Because why on earth would you want to hang around somewhere where there isn't anything for you to do? And that's why hops get picked in Kent. That's why daffodils are being picked. This is why the fruit and veg industry around Evesham works and in Peterborough. So in a sense, the 3 million people have actually partly plugged our lack of planning. And now we've done the most amazing thing of telling them we don't really want them. 5% of our anaesthetists are from the mainland. I'm currently finding out how many of our midwives, so I think it's much easier to work out how many midwives are European Union citizens, not British citizens, and then ask, well, who is going to help deliver your baby? What kind of midwife are you going to get? But that's the answer. It wasn't planned for. When we did the A8 immigration, we got a large number of people from Poland. The joke in Germany was that we got the get-up-and-go clever Polish people. And then people with a bit less get-up-and-go went to Germany a bit later when Germany opened up. Where we've really lost out on is middle-class Syrians. Where 1 million have turned up, largely middle-class, very able Syrians, very grateful Syrians in Germany. And you can look back at our history, look back at Ugandan Asians, incredibly skilled population now. Look at the Jewish immigrants who went to USA, the most traumatic group of the kinder transport children. The kinder transport children came out on trains and they went off to the States. The highest proportion of Nobel Peace Prizes in the world are held by the kinder transport children. And it's connected with trauma as well. People tend to work very hard when they've had trauma. But there was no plan, there is no plan. There is a belief somehow that the market will provide for our children in our old age, but we're going to stop the market when it comes to immigration, which has been the only thing that has actually been plugging the gap to deal with where we get teachers and medical care workers and university researchers from. I've worked in universities for 30 years. I think it was in Sheffield University, that was 13 years ago, when I first noticed the majority of new appointments were not British. And ever since then, most of my new colleagues, because we don't produce enough people who can be university lecturers at the quality that the students want them to be. So the majority of my new colleagues have come mostly from the European Union. If this ends, what's going to happen to our university? Just last one, a special thing about Oxfordshire. And it is special clear, but of every region in Europe, the region which wins the highest European research funding out of the entire continent is Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire and Berkshire. If we can't bid for that money, we're looking at the biggest reduction in jobs that's ever been seen around Oxford University. You might think, oh, that's only the university. We're the second biggest employer after the hospitals in Oxford, who employ people from the EU, is the car factory. The car factory is now owned by BMW. The car factory employs 3,000 people. Half of those 3,000 people are Eastern European men, because they're the only people willing to work on the last manual line where you have to physically bolt engines in. The six lines which are functioned by 1,100 robots, the robots are looked after by British people. But BMW can put those 1,100 robots into containers and move them to Austria. So what happens to our 1,500 skilled robot technicians in Oxford? If they want to keep their job and BMW decide to move the plant to Austria, they have to go to Austria. And then I think it's a new kind of Alfie the same pet. It's just you don't say pet in the south of England. So we need a new word.
Thanks, Ben. We're going to run out of time, but there's a gentleman here with a question. If we can keep the question and answer brief, and I'm not sure we're going to be able to fit any more questions in, but if you go ahead, put it in. Thank you.
Briefly, I'm a fellow geographer, an upper geographer, with quantitative inclinations.
Yeah. Thank you.
So there's still two of us left.
Excellent.
I'd like to suggest, if this hasn't happened already, that the various governments in Britain, devolved governments, London devolved government, Westminster, should be tapping your brain and your results for all kinds of advice. And so I hope they're doing that. I don't know if they are, but I hope they're doing that. And I'm sure if you go along to see Nicholas Sturgeon, she'll be happy to know that you've produced further evidence from Scotland going independent and remaining in the European Union.
Okay.
That's a big question.
Short answer. Scotland's very lucky. I'll make somebody upset, but the Edinburgh Geosciences Department's incredible. Glasgow geography's very famous. Aberdeen and Dundee and St Andrews. You're lucky in Scotland. But you're very lucky with your universities. I haven't been asked much from Scotland. I have recently, in the last couple of weeks, been asked to go to three meetings in November in London for various government departments, where the question is, how can we make the most out of Brexit? And I can't help feeling that the senior civil servants are inviting me because they really don't think I'm going to help them. Why are they inviting me to talk about opportunities? This includes in farming. Opportunities to make the most out of Brexit. Well, they must know, if they know anything about me, that I know where the farm labourers come from. You know, and we're going to have to change what we farm very, very, very quickly if we are going to stop allowing the people who come in and pick our crops from coming.
We have to call it a day there. I'm sorry that there are people with questions that we weren't able to hear, but we are under pressure to get ourselves out of this venue so they can prepare for the next event. Danny will be signing books, copies of his book, and in the signing tent, which is just next door to this, just kind of behind where I'm sitting. Come and join us there. If you have a question that you weren't able to ask, come and ask us. Ask Danny there. We'll be around and be able to chat to you. You've been a great audience. You've asked great questions. Just join me in saying big thanks to Danny Bell.